Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, November 13th, 2025. I am Matt Leck, in for Emma Vigeland, who would be in for Sam Cedar. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcast... Oh, I already said that. Oh, no, I didn't. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Fabian Holt, author of Organize or Burn, and Lawrence Wang, author or organizer for New York Public Power, talking with Emma about some ways we can address climate change. Also on the program today, Starbucks workers launch open-ended strike on Red Cup Day, folks. Tap in. Over 12,000 unionized baristas in 650-plus stores strike for contract, first contract after 4 years, citing 500-plus labor law violations by the company. Check that out if you are a Starbucks consumer. You want to support your local workers. Also on the program today, story everyone's talking about, the Epstein emails reveal that Trump, quote, knew about the girls and a whole bunch of other connections and conversations Jeffrey Epstein's been having with very powerful people, highly connected everywhere. We'll be covering that a lot in the next couple weeks, I think. Also, Rep. Adelita Grijalva finally swore in after a 50-day GOP delay. The Arizona Democrat takes oath after 7 weeks standoff with Speaker Mike Johnson. Everything looking good there, Brian? Okay, cool. I'm just making sure. It's just me and Brian today, folks.
No, you're good. You focus on hosting.
All right.
Got you.
Operation Pedophile Distraction. Trump's Caribbean administration's Caribbean military strikes are facing allied pushback. Let's hope it does more than their pushback on Israel's genocide in Gaza. And AI's boom environmental cost more than we thought. Taiwan using up a huge chunk of their water for new fabrication processes. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Matt. How's it going in there?
It's going pretty well. I'm about to launch a show with David Griscom on The Jacobin Show, so I thought I'd do a little coup here for a promotional...
Sam is duct taped to a chair in the back of the room.
Exactly. He'll be back tomorrow from a secure location. we'll talk a lot about the Epstein. So now that I'm in this chair, I need to actually know how to pronounce this sort of stuff. So Epstein.
No, you don't.
That's actually true. Actually, I'm very qualified to take this spot over. The Epstein emails, and not just with Trump, but with Larry Summers, with pretty much the entire cast of villains of the past like 15 years. Nasty stuff going on. We're going to talk a lot about that once we get Brandon and Binder in here. But I do want to start off with the Red Cup Day strikes that Starbucks workers voted, unionized workers voted overwhelmingly to conduct here. We have some sound from this, Brian.
Yeah. This is Zarian Pouncey. He's been a barista in Vegas at Starbucks for 13 years. And this was taken from, I guess Michael Moore was interviewing him. And this is just him setting up what's happening today.
And while you bring that up, I'll just say, like, the importance of baristas to an economy like Las Vegas, where you're going to need that caffeine in the morning on all days of the week. Let's see this.
My name is Zarian Pouncey. I'm a barista in Las Vegas, Nevada. I've been with Starbucks for about 13 years, and I've been with Starbucks Workers United since 2023. So currently the major demand is we just want them back at the table. Staffing, scheduling, better take-home pay, and we're not afraid to go on strike if necessary. It's not just us partners. It's our customers that come in every day. It's the connections that we make, and our customers care about us. So one of the biggest asks that I have for anyone that goes into a Starbucks that appreciates the barista, that appreciates the team that makes their coffee every morning and, you know, checks on them when they're having a bad day. If you see us on strike on Thursday, just don't go to Starbucks. Try a different coffee shop. Try something local. One of the biggest things that anybody can do to help is visiting nocontractnocoffee.org and RSVP for a Red Cup Day rally, which will also be on the 13th, 4 p.m. local times. Being in the union has been life-changing to me. I used to be the kind of yes, sir, kind of like drank the company's green Kool-Aid for years. It's like, oh yeah, I have some complaints here and there, but you know, it comes with the job. Just deal with it. And reaching a point of, no, I'm not going to deal with that. No, I'm not going to just smile and nod and just take whatever comes my way happily. Meeting other delegates across the U.S. and, you know, finding that connection in similar stories, but then finding connection in some painful, traumatic things has been like the greatest thing. Back when I started in this union.
So definitely tune in, especially if you are usually go to Starbucks. Don't cross the picket line and look at how you can support your local Starbucks workers. This is a really important fight, really, really, really important for what the message it sends to broader corporate America. That's really what's at stake here. The financial hit that a Starbucks corporate would take is easily manageable for having a unionized workforce that could easily give them a contract. But what that would do would be to signal to workers all across America, not just at Starbucks, but at every corporation, that they can win. And we need to push them over, help push them over the goal line here. So, solidarity with all these Starbucks workers, Godspeed. We have a couple ads. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, also, I was going to add, we've had a couple of interviews with union leaders from Starbucks that I'll post a link to throughout this fight. We've had them on like 3-4 times, like I think since I've been here.
Yeah.
Like 6 months. We've been on this one. So I'll just post links to those so you guys can get more background on it.
Yeah, and for any of those workers listening, and I've said this to like the Philly Whole Foods workers and stuff like that, like you're my favorite. Union people fighting the union fight are, I don't mean to play favorites, but you're my favorites.
We got ads from OneSkin and ZocDoc.
Yeah, we got two ads. The other two hosts are going to be here with some great products for you to check and services for you to check out. So here is either Sam or Emma. It will be Emma.
I'd like to thank OneSkin for sponsoring today's episode. OneSkin sent me the OS1 Face, a moisturizer and longevity serum, all in one. And the OS01 Eye, their most concentrated formula to treat the delicate skin around the eyes. I've got sensitive skin. I get red at the drop of a hat. I need to make sure that I maintain my skin. And I've also been, you know, in true New Jersey fashion, a little bit way too obsessed with tanning. I've moved to the spray tan phase and not trying to devastate my skin anymore, or the at-home rub-in one. People may not enjoy that, but it's the only way that I don't punish myself by laying in the sun whenever I can in the summer. And also OneSkin helps me out with that as well. Taking care of it, trying to be proactive, and the OS1 Eye in particular, that formula that you put on your eyes, it's really gentle, but you can feel that it's moisturizing. And especially when the seasons are changing, you've got harsher air, your skin gets drier. And then obviously I'm in the summer, I got a little sun damage and it's October and I've got to recuperate. I need a little bit, more a consistent moisturizer. I really appreciate the OS1 Eye for that very reason. And I've been using it for around 3 weeks at this point, and I've already started to feel the benefits from it. I feel a little bit more brightness. And I feel like the eye cream is probably the best eye cream I've ever used. And I've tried a few. Every formula is dermatologist tested, safe for sensitive skin, and NEA approved, delivering powerful results with skin health in mind. The packaging is great. You've got this reusable shell for the moisturizer, and it's just an easy couple of pumps. It goes on smoothly and easily. This season, don't just moisturize, support your skin at the cellular level with OneSkin. For a limited time, you can try OneSkin with 15% off using code MAJORITY at oneskin.co. That's 15% off OneSkin with code MAJORITY. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please help us and tell them the Majority Report sent you. Try OneSkin today. We'll put a link down below in the video and episode descriptions and at majority.fm. Get 15% off OneSkin with code MAJORITY at www.oneskin.co.
You know, folks, as I get older, as I am, I'm constantly thinking to myself, I should go to the doctor more. Because I'm getting older. I got to deal with the stress from work. I got to deal with my neck pain. I got to deal with all sorts of nagging things. But it's a huge pain to go to the doctor. I want to keep myself healthy, but our medical system makes it extremely difficult. And it almost like gives you a headache just thinking about it. However, I have a solution for you if you're like this. It's called ZocDoc. They make it so easy to find the right fit and book an appointment for fast, so fast, and you do it directly on their website. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare high-quality in-network doctors and click instantly to book an appointment. And not just, you know, doctors, like dentists, too. ZocDoc lets you book in-network appointments with more than 100,000 doctors across every specialty. You can filter for doctors who are near you. You can filter from doctors who take your insurance and are near you. You can filter for doctors who are near you, take your insurance, and are just like a good fit for you. Maybe you want a bedside manner. Maybe you want fast wait times. Maybe you want a doctor that listens well. All of these things you can find on ZocDoc. And then the beauty of ZocDoc is there's no like, can you do Tuesday at 3? No, I can't. What about Wednesday at 5? No, I can't. You go on ZocDoc and you can see their actual appointment openings. You choose a time that works for you and boom, click, you book a visit. Appointments made through ZocDoc also happen quickly and typically fast. Like just 24 to 72 hours is the typical lead time that you need. You can even get same-day appointments. Matt's used ZocDoc. I've done it when I was on the road, tried to get a dentist. Want to thank ZocDoc for sponsoring today's episode. Check it out. Honestly, makes going to see the doctor not a pain in the neck. That really should be their, that should be the catchphrase. That should be the logo, but they can have that for free. Stop putting off those doctor's appointments and go to ZocDoc.com/majority. Find and instantly book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/majority. ZocDoc.com/majority. We'll put that and all the ads in today's podcast and YouTube descriptions. Now, back to Matt.
We are back, and we are joined now by Lawrence Wang, longtime Public Power New York organizer, and Fabian Holt, author of Organize or Burn, How New York Socialists Fight for Climate Survival. Lawrence and Fabian, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. Really excited to talk to you about New York DSA and the organizing successes of New York DSA in this moment in particular, given what happened last week. We're recording this a little bit after, before people are listening to it. But maybe Lawrence, you can start and just speak a little bit about Zora Mamdani's successful campaign, an enormous upset starting at 1% in the polls as a Democratic Socialist and winning the mayoral race, and what that means for DSA in the city more broadly.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a monumental win for the left at large, but especially for DSA and for Democratic Socialism. And what is so great about it is that it actually encapsulates exactly what we did also to help pass the Bill Public Renewables Act, which were is the subject of Fabian's book. And it's because basically, you know, at the very basis of our organizing is that we don't trouble ourselves with what is possible. Instead, we focus on what we make it to make it inevitable. And, you know, Zoran, he came from, as you said, 1% behind. Nobody knew him except for everyone in DSA. But through organizing, through clever organizing, but also an unmitigated message of what is possible of a better world that we can build. And through, of course, a fantastic field program, what New York City DSA is well known for, and extremely powerful communications, is able to turn that 1% into right now the mayor-elect of New York City, the greatest city in the world.
Yeah. And Fabian, can you touch a little bit on that, on organizing as a principle? Because what we've been trying to emphasize on the show is that, you know, these candidates that come with like a flashy resume or with traits on paper that would make sense to become some sort of public official, they don't have DSA's organizing power behind them. And so they're more likely to rely on things like corporate donations. And that's kind of how the party, the Democratic Party, became toothless. It doesn't have what DSA has. Just if you could just speak about the importance of doing politics in that way and how that leads to actual change. Not just the policies, it's the way of doing politics that moves the needle.
Absolutely. I think what we are seeing now is like the acceleration of the collapse of the centrist sort of faction of, you know, corporate Democrats. It's been they've been able to hold on to power for decades, but now like they become so remote from the lives of ordinary people that when you have someone who's sort of really connected and sort of listen to ordinary people and their needs and their grievances, it's very powerful. And what I would like to say is that also the Democratic Socialist Movement in New York City and with the DSA in particular, I see it as a culture. It's not just a strategy or something you would sort of develop like quickly over a few months. DSA has built a culture of grassroots democracy, and it's an organization that's in some ways sort of relatively simple. It's grounded in sort of grassroots democracy and you know, sort of running campaigns where people are sort of motivated by having influence and being heard and not being talked to, like, you know, just, you know, hand out flyers. So they're involved in the internal democratic process. But on top of that, you also have like an organization that has, you know, like committees who are working together across the organization, across the city. So it's actually more complicated. It's not just a simple, you know, canvassing organization. But to build and I think, you know, it's also interesting. So why did this not happen in Los Angeles, for instance? It's another big city, or Chicago. There's been some success in Chicago, but I think in New York, the movement culture really sort of, you know, has become really strong, and it took off, you know, immediately after Trump won the first time when DSA started organizing elections. It created an electoral working group, and so New York City DSA sort of was leading this development, pioneering this development sort of for democratic socialism nationally.
And can you expand on that, Lawrence, a little bit? And you can even tie in some of the early work on the climate crisis and how that got started. But what is it about New York and the conditions of the city and even of the state government, too? Because we're seeing how influential DSA has been in sending people to Albany, including, of course, Zohran Mamdani as an assemblyman. What is it about the city that has created those conditions, in your opinion, that Fabian just spoke about?
I think you have a very complex soup here that makes it all possible. One is that New York does have a well-developed left organizational culture that does exist right beforehand, right? Mostly in nonprofits and in unions, right? Mm-hmm. New York is a union town. It definitely has a presence that doesn't exist, for example, in the South, right? You're not going to find many cities that have the same strong union cultures or union organizations or less organized groups there. But also New York has a very strong culture of socialism. And you combine that history with the many, many working class people and organizers and people who come up through this world and also who move here too. It's a world of both the native New Yorkers as well as the transplants, but people who are all invested in the idea of, we are in the richest city, in the richest country in the world. Why can't we have a better life? Why can't we envision something bigger than just what is, the centrist politicians, the corporate politicians will sell us? We can do bigger. We have done better in the past. We have seen other examples around the world. Why can't we pull it in here? So I think the combination of existing culture, the collection of universities and education people there, and also, again, like the combination of both working class and the precariat, right? People who are coming, who are highly educated or went through college education and then realize that the system as it is will not actually provide any safety net for us, will not give those things possible. And I think
how about Occupy, too? I mean, I think that everything, Occupy being central here, that the shadow of that, I mean, obviously the Obama administration, I think, kind of defanged it a little bit, but there was still that energy there. And that has gone, it seems to me, towards DSA.
Absolutely. I think that Occupy is a great example of that energy kind of, kickstarting, creating a huge movement, creating that kind of base, I think like that huge energy that we saw around. Actually, one of the people behind BPRA, one of our chief strategists and organizers, Patrick Robbins, came up through Occupy, right? I think it's actually the lessons of Occupy that actually helped develop the DSA, because we saw that there was immense interest and energy and popularity around our ideas, but there was no organization. And the rise of DSA, especially during Bernie's first run and the first Trump administration, made us realize we cannot count on the centrists or corporate Democrats to help us. We can't count on necessarily the nonprofits or NGOs to pick up the slack. And we cannot hope for hope that the working class masses will just spontaneously erupt each time and then be able to create the formations we need to institute real change. We're going to have to develop it ourselves, and kind of a little bit of that feeling of also, I think, not having the same experience with, the new left, right, in the 70s, 80s of crackdowns and being able to like start something new. We're like, we don't know the same mistakes, but we also don't have the same hangups. We can start something new and try something different. And I think that was actually essential for us to cast away the shadow of the past to actually build something new.
Yeah. And so Fabian, take us to that, the building of something new too. And then we can really just talk about how eco-socialism is so central to that, especially when we're seeing the rise of eco-fascism. I mean, I don't necessarily think that movement is fully formed yet, but we see shadings of it obviously in the ICE Gestapo terrorizing immigrant communities. And because many of those communities are here forced to migrate either due to political conditions or due to climate conditions. But even the war on public health and the like pseudo eugenicism of a guy like RFK Jr., who basically wants to kind of hollow out our public health institutions and so people just fend for themselves. This is the kind of thing that could preview what an eco-fascist worldview could look like. And yet in New York State, the fight for eco-socialism and to build something around that greener future is very much alive and has, of course, you know, had success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the I mean, certainly like Trump's second term has really changed this sort of the political environment like enormously. I think I mean, so I really like what Lauren said before about, you know, about the energy from Occupy. I think I would like to sort of, you know, just add to that and say, you know, so people always ask, so what's special, what's distinct about New York City DSA and the Democratic Socialist Movement? I think like one way of explaining it is that behind the scenes in sort of the in terms of organizational sort of machine of DSA is this sort of the tradition of movement leadership coming from the civil rights movement. But that sort of movement leadership and sort of community organizing has been exploited like very much in neoliberalism as a sort of an apolitical, you know, tool for organizing for anything and just sort of mobilizing people. And what DSA has done, which is really unique, I think, is that it has actually adopted that sort of, you know, organizational approach like into an explicitly socialist context. So and into electoral politics. So where you have all these NGOs, you know, using the same methods of community organizing and to some extent movement leadership, they're mostly apolitical and they are not sort of they're not channeling energy and power into the like into government into electoral politics. So I think the structural organizational sort of outlook of DSA is very important, and it's also what sort of created sort of the long term organizational capacity of DSA compared to many movements that have died out of the 2010s. Now actually DSA has grown, and you know the victory with Soran it just shows like how powerful, how important sort of long term organizational capacity is. And that is also what we are seeing with Public Power in New York. The Public Power campaign is also not just like a one-year thing or like 6 months. It was 4 or 5 years, and they were able to pass this important legislation. And I think what we are seeing now really is the question, you hear public power organizers, you know, demand like sort of 15 gigawatts, and people sort of listening to this might say, okay, so why this number? Are they pushing for are they just ambitious? But this is really the question at the core of the current situation is Governor Hochul going to side with the climate obstructionists? Or is she going to meet the legally mandated goals of 2030, like they were decided in 2019 with the Climate and Community Leadership Act? So it's really a question of, it's not a question of a movement that is protesting or sort of all the noise that you're going to hear and some people, you know, trying to create attention somewhere. The big problem is actually the opposite, is that the quiet hand of the really, really powerful climate obstructionist movement is threatening this democratically sort of made decision for New York to decarbonize.
I probably should have started asking for a little bit more details on like this effort here, but it's really important that people understand how New York DSA is leading the way here. Can you speak a little bit about I don't have it off the top of my head, or the New York Climate and what's the name of the act? Apologies.
To the New York Climate and Community Leadership Act.
There we go. If you could just tell our audience a little bit more about that act and DSA's involvement in pushing it forward.
Yeah, so I mean, I can start and maybe Lawrence can take over. In 2018 came this this really influential report from the ICCP, the International, sort of Climate Research sort of unit of the UN. And the report was grim. It created shockwaves. It helped sort of kickstart the Green New Deal movement sort of nationally, and it kickstarted the youth sort of climate movement globally. And so the year after New York state government, passed the Climate and Community Leadership Act. It's hard, difficult to say, yeah. So it was a step for the state government to do some climate action, right? So they set this goal, 2030 goal, of reducing sort of greenhouse gas emissions, and the Public Power Campaign and DSA proposed the Build Public Renewables Act as a solution to reach that goal. And the problem right now, like I said before, is that we have the climate obstructionists who are intervening and trying to destroy that.
Yeah, I'll carry on this one. And also, just so we don't get crucified for this, it is the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. We always remember it as the acronym CLCPA. It's all acronyms for here. Sorry, guys. CLCPA, BPRA, it's going to keep on happening.
Okay, well, that makes me feel better that I couldn't remember it then. So,
Oh, don't worry. That's how I go, CLCPA. Someone goes, what is that? I'm like, you know what? It's just the climate law.
Just,
I want to actually give a little context
there. Yeah.
Because I think it's super interesting, and everything's connected. So for people who are not as familiar with New York politics, prior to 2018... then Governor Cuomo kept control of the state politics through the IDC, the Independent Democratic Caucus, I believe that one is, which was basically just Republicans dressed up as Democrats.
Yep. Cuomo basically incentivized through a bunch of deals and goodies that he gave to these Democrats to have the D next to their name, but caucus with the Republicans, the Independent Democratic Conference Caucus. And so there were a lot of people who were voting for Democrats and didn't realize they were essentially voting for Republicans, which gave a built-in excuse for Andrew Cuomo not to do anything progressive or listening to the Democrats in his legislature. There you go.
Exactly. Classic Cuomo. Mm-hmm. In 2019, there was essentially the dismantling of the IDC through elections of progressive politicians. Not necessarily all DSA. In fact, the only DSA one was our very own Julia Salazar, the first New York City DSA elected. But that was the first start. And actually, that is, the general upswell against Cuomo and, of course, against Trump, which is very tied together, as always. That led to the passage of the CLCPA, which did set out genuinely great goals for the state to become decarbonized, to go off of fossil fuels, to become renewable, to cut down our energy uses in a way that becomes more green and becomes also healthier for us all. The issue at hand that Fabian was speaking about was there was really no muscle behind it. It was a law, but of course, if you're a legislator, you can ignore the law. Why we identified this as a terrain of struggle was twofold. One was New Yorkers hate our energy grid system as it is right now. If you live in New York, as New York City, Con Ed sucks and everyone hates Con Ed. So we identify it as like this is a terrain of struggle, which makes sense because what is the one thing other people need besides healthcare and housing? Energy. And as there's Medicare for all, there is housing for all, there should be energy for all, and that should be owned and operated by the people. Through that program, we identified that the New York Power Authority, a state-owned, public-owned utility that was created by FDR with the express purpose at the time to give back to the people the water power which is theirs, right? It was meant to be democratizing power in a real way. But under more recent leadership over the past years, under neoliberalization, it's become much, much more focused on corporate giveaways and less about actually giving power back to the people. So we identified it as a route, a terrain of struggle for us to take to create a law that would empower the state to build the renewable energy we need to satisfy and meet the goals of the CLCPA. And that's, the overall reason part of that, not even just like from the reason of universality, which is the key to, of course, everything with democratic socialism, is even the basic idea that what good is it to have a world where the workers are in power, where we have the democratic means to really control our society, if the world is falling apart, if it's burning, right? We have the center climate in that work. And that's why eco-socialism is so important to socialism, is that we have the only way to build that world, that universal world, is if we have a world in the first place.
Right, right. And I think also when you connect it to people's material experience, it's a lot, as you're saying, Lawrence, it's just so much more politically salient. And that is where you can see how liberal climate do-gooderness has been a major failure. I think, you know, there's a lot of people who want to be good people and want to be, you know, not gluttonous and not so wasteful in this environment. And they'll focus on things like, you know, composting, which is great if you can do that individually, or, you know, eating the right way, not having that much red meat. But the reality is that for so many people who don't have that luxury, their personal consumption choices are not enough. And in fact, making it a personal consumption choice really hurts the political salience of a climate movement. It makes people feel like you're a bunch of nags that want them to stop eating hamburgers. And when you make it like your Con Ed, my Con Ed bill, I don't know about you guys, but the past few months has been, I get an email, it's 53% higher than, I'm like, I'm not using the air conditioning this month. Why is it 53% higher than when it was in July or whatever, when I'm using my air conditioning? And it's, it seems like it's because of these data centers. I know I'm taking us a little afield of the book, but like all of this AI stuff and these data centers chewing up all the energy, this is going to increasingly become a political issue over the next 3 or 4 years under the Trump administration. That's just like letting AI do whatever they want and a bunch of governors being on board with it.
Yeah, no, it's it actually is one of the biggest things. I was actually at a public power convening just a month ago, where a bunch of public power organizers from across the country were brought together by a group called Public Grids to talk about public power and how we take back our utilities and take back also our energy usage. And actually, one of the organizers who worked on BPRA and helped pass it, Lee Zeesh, is helping lead the fight in Arizona that actually stopped the Project Blue being built by Amazon, right, with Tucson. She's helping lead Tucson DSA's fight there. So the energy usage and ownership of utilities and ownership of the means of generation is interlinked. And I think that's something that I really talk about is, we have to control, we have to talk about the material reality of climate change. And the thing is, people know this. Right. I think when you think about it in the polls or think about it on a big scale, people talk about climate, they go, I don't understand it. And actually, when we did very early on, and when we're doing BPRA organizing, we did some door knocking, right? And you talk to somebody, I would go to people's homes and I'm knocking on it and say, what do you think about the climate? And people, most people would go, I don't know what it means, right? It doesn't have anything to it. And then you go, do you know somebody who has dealt with a power outage or has been dealing with like after effects still of Hurricane Sandy? Or of any number of things. Or if you have family who have been dealing with like the blackouts in Texas or anything
else.
How
about the flooding if you have a basement apartment? I mean, this is like all over the city. It happens every time there's a big rainstorm.
Exactly. And people go, 100%, I know what's happening. People understand that climate change and not climate change, the climate crisis is real. I think that most people, is like when you think about a big word like climate, they don't get it. Or they don't understand it because it's not real. It doesn't feel real until you connect it back to the material ways. And that's when you can get at a baseline level to go from, here's your material concerns. There's a reason behind it. There's a system that empowers it and makes it possible. Here's a solution to it. And that pathway is literally how we passed BPRA against every all odds and against every opposition possible.
Fabian, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I just want to share an experience I had yesterday. I was talking to I had two students from Spain and one from Italy. And I asked him, so how about these big fires that you had over the summer? Has it changed the conversation, the public conversation about climate change? So because I heard I said to him, yeah, I heard that the fires were particularly bad this year. And they burst out. Yeah, we're burning all the time. Like he said, we're kind of living in a constant state of, you know, we have fires every year, like throughout the year, basically, and they said independently of each other, like from the Italian and the two people from Spain, they said, people know that this is happening, people know that climate change is happening, but no one wants to take responsibility. Politicians are just, you know, they're disgrace. They're not really taking responsibility, and citizens don't know where to go. Like so I think that's I think it's an interesting perspective that climate, because it's this kind of, you know, indirect, process of someone burning fossil fuel somewhere, you know, 10 years later or 30 years later, like we're seeing the impact of that. But the impact are hitting people all over the place. I think my point is that we can appeal. It's important to appeal to sort of, you know, daily economic issues and sort of integrate climate with economic politics, especially at the kitchen table level. But I think it's also important to build understanding beyond that. And I think humans are capable of actually understanding more. I think climate literacy can be improved.
Well said. And lastly, Lawrence here, I mean, just in building off of like what other lessons can there be for other, you know, DSA chapters? Fabian, you touched on it a bit, but, you know, I'm talking to friends out in LA, and actually at the time of this interview, when this airs, I will be out in California. So I'm thinking about that and, you know, why maybe they're behind New York and Karen Bass having failings and not being a democratic socialist, for example. Like, in the wake of those fires, I was frustrated by the national conversation about, you know, blaming Karen Bass for being abroad or mismanagement in certain areas. Like, it was certainly, she's not my favorite type of Democrat, but it was like, not to pardon the crude metaphor, but like, we're missing the forest through the trees here. I understand that there are critiques of her governance, but this is about something bigger. This is about the climate crisis. This isn't about people taking shots at people of color who run cities, which is what it kind of felt like, at least on the national level. I want my friends in LA to be able to take some lessons from this fight and be able to organize there in DSA and have the effects that we're seeing in New York. So what would your lesson be on that front?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that makes New York City DSA more, you know, ahead of this fight for now is that, honestly, it comes down to many things, which one first thing is we're not afraid to try new things. And I want to explain that in the context of BPRA and also with regards to Zoran, right? We started off, like, you know, the fight to build public renewables in many ways starts in like earnest with our fight to start to stop the NRG energy plant in Queens. Mm-hmm. And that was a fight that was led by DSA, led among other community groups. But at the time, it was also a chief plank of Zoran Mamdani's run for assembly. He actually turned his office into an organizing space for us to reach out to neighbors who are being canvassed, as is also being supported during the pandemic with mutual aid support, with, hey, like, we are also organizing not just to elect Zoran Mamdani, but also to fight against this, against the building on this energy, this fracked gas plant. Let's be honest what it was, a fracked gas plant run by a multinational. And Zoran was not just like, oh, yeah, you can just do my office. He was front and center in his fights. Right, there's a, you can look at the Queens, I think Queens Chronicle articles where they're just constantly putting him everywhere. Already back then, using Islamophobia against him. Right, there's this stuff out there, and it's because DSA doesn't treat our electeds as, or even our candidates as, just, you know, we are just endorsing you. You are of us. You are a partner in this thing, and that is how that fight leads directly to 2020 when we start 2021. Sorry, when we start kicking off the new version, new organizing of BPRA in earnest, when at the time we were still navigating, this is our first time being in power at New York City DSA, right? We had elected six socialists, in 2020 with Zoran Mamdani, obviously, Farah, Supreme Forest, Jabari, Brisport, Marcela Matenez, Emily Gallagher, and re-electing Julia Salazar. And we now finally have a block of people in power. But we still didn't know anything yet. We're still green behind the ears. And our bill, the BPRA, was taken up by the state senator and energy chair for the state senate, Kevin Parker. And he was telling us, oh, we need to just walk around and like convince all these other legislators to sign on board. And then he'll push the bill through conference. And it is actually Zoran who told us, after just being in office, he was just in the office a few months. He goes like, hey guys, that's not how it works. I'm learning now. This is not how it works. He is sabotaging your bill. Because the reality is, if someone takes up your bill as a sponsor, they're the ones to push it through. And if they don't do it, no one else will sign on, at least in the old rules, right? So we had Zoran and Jabari and everyone else as our DSA electeds running around trying to get sponsors for our bill, come up against walls, though also helping convert some people and learning this is why it's happening. And that's why we said, you know what? Again, throw out the rule book. The traditional NGO nonprofit way would have been, okay, well, let's make nice, we'll play nicer with them, and maybe they'll come around. We said we're going to host a direct action in front of their offices in New York City. The legislative body has an office in New York City. Hosted a direct action where we created these giant Venmo boards, 5x8, huge things, with their faces on it, with their names on it, and framed as like a direct, designed as a Venmo. So you had all their donations from all the fossil fuel corporations and private energy utilities on it. And we made it sure that whenever they took a picture of this action, you saw those boards in the background. And that did more than anything else. We were door knocking, we were canvassing, we were calling, we were doing all these things. But it was that moment of mass media activation that made them go, oh crap, we should call you guys. And again, like that kind of led to the next thing where we realized, okay, we can do direct actions, we can do media moments, but now we need to go beyond that because we knew there's a certain wall. And that led to us running an electoral operation in 2022, where basically the Eco-Socialist Working Group dissolved itself into the Electoral Working Group, headed up the campaigns of David Alexis, who was challenging Kevin Parker directly so that we could pass BPRA, as well as in like the Mid-Hudson Valley. We had members go there to help elect a public power champion, an MH Mid-Hudson Valley DSA member, Sarah Hanna-Shrestha, taking on Kevin Cahill, a 30-year incumbent. And that was a slate of, oh, I forgot how many people, but it was what we called the Green New York slate. It was deliberately a mission where we said electoral will be focusing on climate as our motivational issue. And though we didn't win David Alexis's fight, we did force Kevin New Parker to be so scared that he went into neutrality, let the bill pass the state senate. And eventually, when the bill was passed, he now is touting it as one of his wins. Right, so I think the main thing we come back to is like if we can learn from, and there's more to this story, right? Like then there's the whole fight we had in 2023 to take on Governor Kathy Hochul to pass the bill, which again you can see Zoran front and center with helping us there too. But the thing I want to point out there is like the real lesson is that it is about trying new things, not playing by the rule book, confronting power every opportunity, not being afraid to try new things, making sure that combined, I think Zoran is the best encapsulation of it, which is why I think he's our public power champion as well as the mayor of New York. Is that he is somebody who is not afraid to not just go with the orthodoxy, even within DSA, of, oh, we need to run big field campaigns. Paired big field campaigns with community building, with, as we know, amazing communications, right? These kind of trifecta of things really transformed the campaign. And so what we did in miniature on a statewide level with the Build Public Renewables Act campaign and how we were able to go year on year, winning and winning over, beating new enemies. I mean, we kind of it's almost like a video game. We're beating new bosses every stage of the level every year. And we took this bill that was literally like in 2019 when it was introduced, called a Lefty Loony Bill. No one thought it would ever pass to becoming the number one climate bill and passing and beating and passing in 2023 over Governor Kathy Hochul's objections. She didn't want this bill. She tried to water it down, and we still overcame that.
Incredible stuff. You guys really appreciate your time today. Lawrence Wang, longtime public power New York organizer, Fabian Holt. The book is called Organize or Burn: How the New York Socialists Fight for Climate Survival. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Welcome back, Majority Report listeners. Joining us, Brandon Sutton. Hey, Brandon.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
It's going very well. I also, before we get into what's coming up on the fun half and our plugs, people might have noticed presentation was a little bit different for that. And we're in this little grace period before Emma realizes she has to be mad at technology for how the it sort of skipped around a little bit and was changing in size, which made it impossible for me to edit into the normal Chiron that we usually present. So if people were a little bit confused by the video presentation there, just know that that's not our new new style. But yeah, Brandon, what's going on over at the Discourse?
I mean, we're doing a show every day. And, you know, I like to thank everybody who shows up so early in the morning between 9 to 12 p.m. Eastern to talk about the happenings. Not the M. Night Shyamalan movie, although sometimes, yeah, actually M. Night Shyamalan movie, because I'm a big M. Night Shyamalan fan. But this week we've been discussing the newest Epstein reveals. I say it like a reality TV show, but it's much more disturbing than that. We've been going through the shutdown news, and I think tomorrow we'll maybe do more of the Maha summit. I don't know if you've been watching the Make America Healthy Again summit, but it's happening.
I've missed this. Who is this RFK led? I assume he's going to be there.
Oh yeah, no, like they had like the opening, I guess, salvo, but a tete between him and JD Vance yesterday, and so I'm looking forward to the rest of the programming. I hope it's not just that one thing.
Is JD Vance Maha?
He's trying to be.
Hmm.
Okay. He might just be on Ozempic.
My judgment on that.
We have been to here, but I'm having some layout issues, so give me a second. But
oh, good,
because you're in a different chair, so Thursday's layout is different.
Oh, you can't find the Sam one because I'm in Sam's chair. If you you want to cut to a break a little bit, and then we'll bring Binder in.
Yeah.
All right. And there's all the boys. Binder, plug away.
Yeah, sure. Great to be here with the guys today. And you, as I choke, youtube.com/MattBinder tonight, 8:30 p.m. for Leftist Mafia. And I believe next week, is this true, Brandon? You're going to be joining us next week on Leftist Mafia?
I thought it was the week after next, but now I think that would be Thanksgiving. So
that
we'll
would
have
be Thanksgiving.
To reconvene. Well, maybe we'll see. Let's see.
I know you don't celebrate Thanksgiving anymore, but
That's because I'm thankful 24/7, 365 or 366 days a year, depending on if it's a leap year or not.
All right.
You know, sometimes some people like to be thankful like all the time, but I suppose that's a high bar for the average American.
I think you need to be unthankful to really appreciate being thankful. You need to be a selfish. Speaking of being selfish, I have plugs. Tomorrow, I'm very pleased to announce the Jacobin Show is returning. Produced by me, and I'm also on it, and David Griscom is hosting. So at 10 a.m. tomorrow, folks, be ready for the first show with Eric Blanc and Ashiq Sadiq, two prominent DSA-aligned, DSA socialist thinkers, talking about Zoran's victory and what it portends. And go subscribe to Jacobin now, because, you know, we want to look good to the people at Jacobin that gave us this opportunity. And so I'm very excited about that. That'll be, again, tomorrow at 10 o'clock Eastern on the Jacobin YouTube channel.
Cool.
And nice. With that, thank you, guys. With that said, let's go to the fun half.
Is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
We are back on this Matt and Brandon Thursday. Remember the For the Boys thing? That don't we miss that already? That was about 4 years ago. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing well.
I'm like I said, I can smell the testosterone. When it's all men here, it just smells different. I hope our audience can also experience that.
Yeah. We're here to save musky. Your sons with masculinity and erudition.
The alpha males are back.
And you could smell it across the Atlantic, so imagine how it must smell over here.
it's carrying over by the weakened jet stream, just wafting masculinity. Yep. Speaking of that's a bad transition.
Speaking of masculinity.
Speaking of toxic masculinity.
Jeffrey Epstein.
our president.
Transatlantic toxic masculinity. Let's talk about Jeffrey Epstein. Fox News has been loath to cover this for a while, except for the brief period where they thought they could make it look like it was Hillary Clinton who's responsible for everything that happened. Even all this stuff that happens when Trump was in office, like the COVID shutdown and Jeffrey Epstein being killed in prison, and people act like Biden was president.
Yeah, they don't. They literally think that. It's also really funny too, the Clinton stuff, because on our side they're not our heroes, so people are like, "What about Clinton too?" And it's like,
"What about him? Let's get him in jail to jail them too."
But it doesn't even help. It's actually they're not helping. We're the ones who have the criticisms of the Clintons. They're not helping by making them look like some kind of puppet master of the world. They're like corporate sellouts that destroy the Democratic Party. But
As far as I know, Hillary's still out of prison. You know, for all the talk about Hillary Clinton being the mastermind and lock her up, and all talk about Joe Biden like manipulating the Epstein files and all of these crimes, they're all still walking free. Like, last I heard, the only one indicted was Comey and Bolton and a few other like low-hanging fruit. And so it does seem very suspicious that if they're so guilty of like manipulating this sort of information, that they're not, being held to task by the Trump administration.
Yeah.
Instead, she's fighting for TikTok to not be so pro-Palestinian. That's her move these days.
Yeah, do we have that clip for later?
I can find it.
Oh my god. Okay, well, we've
let's reset for work. Let's hit one of these guys at a time.
That's the thing, is like this is we're a parody of leftists. We're supposed to be attacking the right now. We get sidetracked by other Epstein associates, including, actually Hillary Clinton's the one in that family behind her husband and her daughter that are like.
Also, to be fair, Hillary comes up in this latest Epstein document dump where I think it was Epstein or someone Epstein's emailing references her and Vince, which people are assuming is Vince Foster. But again, not the focus. Let's recalibrate back on Trump.
Don't add Trump.
Honestly, right. This is America. There are enough jail cells for everybody. There's enough jail cells for everyone involved. That's the one thing you can say about this country.
That's legit actually a crisis that our country is facing right now, because we overproduced jail cells and did mass incarceration. And now that population is aging out of prison. And we need to figure out how we're going to keep that industry alive in communities that rely on jailing people. That's part of our freak out now, and part of why, something as seemingly simple and popular as liberalizing drug policy in this country is sending the entire economy of certain cities. Because what happens when you arrest somebody from a city and jail them in a suburban community is they count towards the population of the place they're jailed for political representation purposes. So it's a great little political system we got working here.
Well, speaking of overproducing, we're also, now that Trump is president, overproducing copium. So let's take a look at this Fox News clip.
Yes.
So here is a good segue.
Here's Will Cain of Fox News. This is about yesterday afternoon?
This was the 4 p.m. news block, which apparently was the first time they mentioned these emails that whole day. And they still leave out, I believe, at least 2 out of 3 of the emails.
All right. More, by the way, from Capitol Hill today. House Democrats releasing new Epstein emails, some of them referencing President Trump. The White House is pushing back on those emails and how the media is portraying them. Fox News senior White House correspondent Peter Ducey has the latest. Peter.
And, Will, officials here at the Trump White House, of course, would rather talk about their efforts to get the government reopened, something they hope happens later on today. But instead of just talking about that, they are also talking about these newly released emails, including this one from 2011. It is Jeffrey Epstein emailing his accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell. This one says, I want you to realize that the dog that hasn't barked is Trump. Victim, redacted name, spent hours at my house with him, has never once been mentioned. Officials here, though, are puzzled about why Democrats redacted the name of a victim since that victim wrote a whole book about all this.
These emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong. And what President Trump has always said is that he was from Palm Beach, and so was Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago until President Trump kicked him out because Jeffrey Epstein was a pedophile and he was a creep. And
pause this it. Email. Is that what you do when you find out right. that somebody is a elite sex trafficking pedophile? You just
you can't no be part of my club anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it is what you do when he's poaching your specific girls, which is what we've heard before. I mean, because you know, there's only enough room for like one alpha male in the pride, right? So you got to kick him out.
And if you ask me, that seems like that more likely is the reason why Trump decided this guy can't come to my exclusive club anymore, more so than Trump going, disgusting, how dare you, you pervert. I mean, it seems like that's the reason.
He remember when Trump was basically addressing these exact emails, it now looks like, earlier in the summer, and he said that weird thing about, like, he took her from me, he took one of my girls, like, he, which means, like, he was as a, what, 60, however, 50-year-old hotelier on first name basis with one of his teenage spa employees. And then he disinvited him because he was a pedophile, but what, didn't call the fucking cops about this? And also then Epstein was killed under Donald Trump's administration. And in fact, Attorney General William Barr, the former, former Attorney General, was, you look up his dad, Donald Barr, who, interestingly, was a member of the OSS, which is the forerunner to the CIA during World War II. And then he was the headmaster at the Dalton School that hired Jeffrey Epstein when he was 21 years old to work with children. So full circle for that, the Barr family. You know, to me, I don't know, what's your guys' reaction to what we saw yesterday and what keeps coming out?
I mean, to me, the most interesting thing is that how recent some of these emails are. Like, that to me is the biggest, you know, there was obvious speculation and, you know, and a lot of people, I think at this point we all know that Trump was involved with Epstein in some way. And it's more than what I guess the Ezra Klein's of the world would want us to believe, where Jeffrey Epstein just happened to be living two separate lives and they didn't interact, which is a bizarre thing. We know those worlds interacted. In fact, if you were to make a Venn diagram, it's almost a perfect circle, if not a perfect circle. With the things that would make it not part of the perfect circle might be the spying stuff Epstein was doing, but that's a different video. But to me, the biggest shocker is we have proof that this is not some distant, far, decade plus relationship that Trump had with Epstein. Epstein was talking about Trump, and people interacting with Epstein over these emails were talking about Trump in their life, like not just like referencing the guy in TV, talking about real life interactions and meetings with Trump. And it appears that those interactions go all the way up until pretty damn close to when Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his jail cell.
Yeah, within 6 months.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I guess it doesn't change anything that I think is going on. I think, to me, the most damning thing, well, the two most damning things that we've seen recently were the birthday card, which was, I think, incredibly suspicious as circumstantial evidence, of course, in the way in which Trump reacts to like being questioned about Jeffrey Epstein, the whole Democratic Party hoax thing, the like, are we still talking about that guy stuff? That is very suspicious. And the more evidence of this sort that comes out, the circumstantial evidence comes out between, of Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein's relationship and what grounds were those relationship, was that relationship being had on, essentially, the more it becomes less likely that something above board is possibly the explanation. Because at a certain point, there's just so much circumstantial evidence that you have to question, like, what else could be going on that justifies it? And how could that be possible? Because, you know, and I'm not trying to allege anything, because I know how Donald Trump can be very litigious. But at this point, for it not to be the most like obvious explanation would almost be ludicrous. It'd be like, you know, and I said this on my own stream, but I'll repeat it here. Like, he's some sort of like Mr. Bean for like being like a nonce. Like, he's constantly finding himself accidentally like leaving evidence that he's involved in like a sex trafficking ring. And, you know, Donald Trump is a weird guy, but at a certain point, it just seems like the most likely explanation has to be it, that he wasn't just orbiting around this particular guy. They were best friends. They were best friends. They said he was best friends. Like, and everything seems to lead in that direction. And it seems impossible to like believe that he was at the very least unaware of what was going on in Epstein's life. But he wasn't the only one, obviously.
There's some very weird messages there. Did you see the Tom Barrack one where he, I think our envoy to Syria, diplomat to Syria, said like, "Send me a picture of you and child. Make me happy." These sorts of things, it reminds me of, you know, I think the Donald Trump tape with Billy Bush that came out in 2015 or 16, the famous like grab him by the pussy, they'll let you do anything tape. It is one of the more shocking pieces of media like I still have ever seen, because that is, it is sort of caught on tape, rape culture. And I remember, like, you know, growing up hearing about things like date rape, drugs. I'm like, how does that ever happen? How does a guy ever talk to another guy about sourcing something like that? It's so disgusting. And then you hear people like this talk and you realize, oh, like, this is it. They're just empowered to be predators.
Well, I mean, that's an important point to linger on, because a lot of MAGA people, a lot of like the alpha male podcast space and the people who supported them in that space will pretend like they don't support this, but they really only mean in this incredibly narrow circumstance, because a lot of those people were very happy that Trump was like a sex criminal, you know, allegedly, or was bragging about like participating in sex crimes. They love that he made a certain kind of woman, like the liberal woman, the lady who works in HR, uncomfortable. There was even plenty of evidence that he might like them younger. You know, he, by his own admission, while talking about him and Jeffrey Epstein, it's wild how much evidence is out there. And, you know, now there are people like Joe Rogan are pretending like they're surprised. They're surprised by all of this, but they were in possession of all the facts too. They were obsessed with it, right? So like, this is, you know, in some ways a predictable escalation of what we already knew about Donald Trump and what people who were supporting him were happy to like about and support him about Trump. They had merchandise saying this kind of thing. And now that it's like veered into the territory, the one narrow slice of like sexual misconduct that they had staked their moral reputation on, they're like pretending like, oh, we had no idea. There's nothing to ever indicate that this would be like what Donald Trump was into. It's like, nope, there was actually tons of stuff, not just directly, but like in other areas of his life.
Well, I mean, like, we started from the heaviest evidence and moved backwards. Like, 10 years ago, he said he's a great friend of mine. He loves beautiful women as much as I do.
Exactly.
And he likes them a little young. I mean, that's where we started with his relationship on him.
Yeah.
Like, in the public.
And the Michael Wolff thing, that is the most incriminating one to me that released yesterday, is Michael Wolff saying, hey, let's see how Trump responds to a question about you after the debate in Las Vegas in December of 2015. And if he says, Jeffrey Epstein's a great guy, he's a victim of cancel culture, that's great. Or if he says, I've never been on the plane or to his house, we got him.
Yeah. He'll owe you a debt.
And, I mean, what more do you need to know about this?
To be fair, that's almost what he said when asked about Ghislaine Maxwell that time, where he was just like, don't know her very well, but I wish her well. or whatever like that. Like, so, you know, Jeffrey Epstein was you know, kind of like almost right. It just so happened that it like at the time was something that was like gripping the nation's imagination. And Donald Trump is disloyal. Like everyone knows that Donald Trump does not have your back. Not that you should have the back of someone like Jeffrey Epstein. Too many people apparently have his back to this day, obviously. But like you can't rely on Donald Trump to like, you know, put himself out there if it might implicate his own personal brand. And at that time, it just wouldn't have benefited him. But it seems like a lot of people that might people who are involved in that might be calling, you know, his debt due because Ghislaine looks like she's on her way out the door.
Yeah. Like,
you know.
Yeah. And, you know, there, to back up a little bit, there's also like Peter Thiel is implicated in this. There's so many guys. Right. The Larry Summers stuff about asking advice about how to talk to women is disgusting to me. But there, the Peter Thiel thing is like, look, I've never been to the island. Brother, that's not enough. You are an associate of a sort of sex trafficking pedophile who also is a kingpin of like Zionist intelligence. You should have no, any association with him is a massive alarm that like the government should not be doing business with any of these people. It is insane. All of those contracts should be looked at. Like, we need a complete shutdown of dealing with these elite pedophile associates before we until we can figure out what the hell is going on.
I mean, anyone who had any sort of anyone who had any sort of connection with him after that that stint in jail that he did in what was it 2009, I believe. And like, even if you have a connection with him before that, I'm suspect of you, but at least you have the excuse that you could argue reasonably that you had no idea. But once the guy has been in prison for explicitly doing what he did, the idea that you had no idea or didn't know his character or no, I'm sorry. It's just not a good argument. And then to your point with like Peter Thiel, I mean, it's especially suspect of these guys in terms of like they didn't even like leave the industry. Like they're like defense contractors. Like they're specifically dealing with things where this sort of foreign intelligence would be at play. Like they should not be. It's not like they decided to like, oh, this is I've had it with this, you know, this area. I'm done. I'm out. No, they stayed in. And probably because of something along the lines that they got out of all this.
Yeah. There's like Peter Mandelson, a guy who was some sort of, I think, foreign secretary or something in Keir Starmer's government, who had to leave because the sort of the emails, when the cartoon that Trump made for Epstein came out, he was also shown in messages being like, we're all so angry that you've been arrested for pedophilia, sir. Binder's mic is a little bit hot if you could bring him down there. I'm looking at a article here. Bill Gates met with Jeffrey Epstein many times despite his past. That's an October 2019 article. At Jeffrey Epstein's mansion in 2011, from the left, James E. Staley, at the time, senior J.P. Morgan executive. That's our number one bank in the country, everybody. Former Treasury Secretary Lauren Summer, who again is like asking for advice of how to text a woman from Epstein. Mr. Epstein himself, Bill Gates, Microsoft's founder, and Boris Nikolich, who was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's science advisor. And I would just point out, if there happens to be any sort of MAGA people here that think that Trump is a thumb in the eye to people like Bill Gates, look up where Doug Burgum, Trump's Secretary of Interior, got his billions of dollars from. I'll give you a hint. It's Bill Gates. What were you going to say, Brandon?
I was just going to say, no, also like former Prince Andrew had to relinquish all of his titles recently over the investigation and the fallout from things like this. That's what made the Trump administration's position a few months ago that there was no international trafficking ring. It was all just Jeffrey Epstein. Like, you know, make no sense because people have already been held like at least partially responsible or implicated. A lot of people ended up dead as well, but yeah, you know, a lot of people have already been implicated, so the idea that it was just a lone sex trafficker just didn't make any sense.
Should we do this Peter Ducey one now too, Brian?
Sure.
So this is Peter Ducey, a nepotism case over at Fox News, whose dad, Steve Ducey, is a longtime member of, I believe, The Five. They do another segment on emails here.
This one cracked me up because this is a full minute and 45 seconds of a segment where they talk about the emails, but they don't mention one word of what is in the emails.
Caroline Leavitt fielded questions about the release of those emails from House Democrats related to President Trump and Jeffrey Epstein, calling it a manufactured hoax. That was moments ago at the White House. Our senior White House correspondent Peter Ducey was in that briefing and joins us now. Hi, Peter.
And Sandra, the argument from officials here that was made by Caroline Leavitt in the briefing room a few minutes ago is that there's a tell that shows that these Epstein emails being released today is a partisan exercise by congressional Democrats. This is how she came to that conclusion.
There are no coincidences in Washington, D.C., and it is not a coincidence that the Democrats leaked these emails to the fake news this morning ahead of Republicans reopening the government. This is another distraction campaign by the Democrat and the liberal media, and it's why I'm being asked questions about Epstein instead of the government reopening because of Republicans.
And just a few minutes after Caroline Leavitt went back into her office in Upper Press, President Trump posted this on Truth Social. He said, the Democrats are trying to bring up the Jeffrey Epstein hoax again because they'll do anything at all to deflect on how badly they've done on the shutdown and so many other subjects. Only a very bad or stupid Republican would fall into that trap. He goes on, there should be no deflections to Epstein or anything else, and any Republicans involved should be focused only on opening up our country. The White House also argued that they have been extremely transparent when it comes to Jeffrey Epstein, asking the Justice Department to release
the most transparent
grand jury information, for example, something that a judge ultimately said couldn't be done right now.
I mean, there's a really good reason why this came up yesterday, though, and that's because basically the Republicans, Mike Johnson, basically held the swearing in of Arizona's newest state U.S. representative, Grijalva. I believe that's how you say her name. She won an election, and for weeks, I think even went longer than that, months.
Yeah,
they refused
this predates the shutdown.
Right, they refused to swear her in. They would cite the government shutdown, but the real reason appears to be that because she is the deciding vote that the House needed to vote to release the Epstein documents. And so they held this hostage. And so finally, with the government not shut down anymore yesterday, they had no choice but to swear her in. She became an official member of Congress. And now the U.S. House of Representatives has the votes it needs to get the Epstein files out there. So that's why everyone's talking about it yesterday. It wasn't like they just decided out of thin air, today is a good day to do it, or like what the Trump administration wants you to believe. They just decided to bring it up again as a distraction. No, there was good reason. It was very extremely relevant yesterday.
Also, just to jump in there real quick, because we can all agree that Democrats did not do enough to release this information when they were in charge. But one of the people, I mean, multiple of the people who were in charge of pointing that out and, like, you know, empowered themselves and, like, got themselves bigger platform by keeping this topic alive, now work in high up positions in the Trump administration. And up until they decided that he was a lone trafficker, they were stoking the flames of this particular Democratic Party hoax. Like, Pam Bondi sent those influencers out with those binders that said Epstein file release part one. Like, and then it even said on that binder, I think, the most transparent administration in history. And then, like, 2 weeks later, she was like, just kidding. And so, like, it's them, like the calls coming from inside the House. You're the ones keeping this, like, Democratic Party hoax alive.
And it's not just Democrats that have been demanding this sort of stuff. It's, in fact, the victims of the international pedophile fixer, Jeffrey Epstein. And it also includes Lauren Boebert. I don't think she's a Democrat. Nancy Mace, she's not a Democrat. Is it Marjorie Taylor Greene, the third one? These women.
Thomas Massie.
What are we doing inviting women into this?
Trump brought Boebert into the Situation Room last night.
Look, we got a situation.
Put her in a headlock.
Like, you can't vote for this.
You can't trust women. I mean, give me some of these guys on in the manosphere.
Yeah, believe men.
Boebert, Green, I just can't keep a handle out of them. Yeah, they're siding with the victims. Thankfully, you know, I wouldn't have put my money on that, but and also Thomas Massey.
Well, Boebert and Green both like jockeyed really hard to get into the inner circle of Trump, and he left them out for whatever reason. They're not hot enough or whatever he thinks. Yeah. And so now they have to make their own space.
Right. I mean, it's also possible that they know what's in there, and they know that once it's released, or they have an idea of what's in there exactly. Like, we all have some sort of idea, but they actually know. And so they must know that it's going to come out, and if it comes out, whatever's in there, they voted against it, it would reflect very badly on them. Yeah. So, I mean, it's got to be self-preservation at the very least, you know?
Yeah. Or, I mean, you maybe know. Marjorie Taylor Greene is just, like, a true believer. Like, Trump got a big portion of his base hooked on the kinds of conspiracy theories like Pizzagate, like QAnon, in during his first term. And now a lot of those people have found themselves in local and also, like, national level government, federal government. And, you know, maybe Marjorie Taylor Greene is just a principled conspiracy theorist. She's not like an RFK Jr. who, the moment she gets a little bit of attention, is going to abandon thinking that like chemtrails are real, or going to abandon thinking that like, you know, Pizzagate happened. She's going to actually pursue it to the end. Like, you know, this is just him, like his own, you know, brand biting him in the ass again.
Yeah, and people are correcting me, Tom LaFink. Mandelson was Britain's ambassador to the U.S., international socialist. That Labour politician was Lord Peter Mandelson. Lord. Once Lord. Deputy Prime Minister, one of the trio who invented New Labour. With Blair Brown, he led the campaign to destroy Corbyn. Labour Mandelson made millions through contracts with various oligarchs, dictators, and Epstein. You know, and people mentioned the Epstein spy stuff and Israel stuff. And as Mossad, and just one note I want to make on that, we're going to have Murtaza Hussain on talking about that on Monday, knock on wood. But, and I think I got this from TrueAnon, but when people go into Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, it's not so much that he's like CIA. He's like characterized as above, or not a CIA. He's not characterized as Mossad. He's characterized as like above Mossad, like tells Mossad what to do. And for a while, like, I'd been sort of thinking, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, rich guy, international guy, that's exactly who like intelligence agencies always make use of for this sort of stuff. The stuff that's coming out about not only all of his emails with basically the rulers of the universe, like Larry Summers and all these sorts of folks, and including like, I guess, Michael Wolff. Also, the sort of geopolitical role that he played in, and that's exactly what we're going to talk about next week. But like, he's above he's not just an intelligence asset. He is like a kingpin of intelligence. He's not Mossad. He's like, again, like above Mossad. So, you know, crazy times. And I don't know if it's there's no coincidences in Trump's Washington DC, and I don't know if it's a coincidence that all of this is coming out now, but
no coincidences in Washington, but a lot of coincidences in West Palm Beach, apparently.
It's just a coincidence. Okay,
everyone knows everybody.
Yeah, let's see here.
That's like Cuomo's defense about the Trump donors. Well, he's from New York. I'm from New York.
People are saying that John Fetterman had a fall.
Like a physical fall?
Yes.
A pratfall?
Cranking my hog, says.
Breaking news 2 days in a row.
Hospitalized? What? I mean,
whoa.
What
kind of
Fetterman is?
He's not like an old guy.
I mean, at least
Tim Burr.
The vehicle behind the wheel of an SUV this time. Seems like a very unwell man who should not be in the Senate, would be, you know, my comment on that. But, you know, hope he recuperates well enough to resign. let's see, what other fun stuff should we play Nikki Haley's son?
Oh, yeah.
Have you guys seen this? We've got a new...
No.
So I've seen his name going around, but I haven't seen this clip. Let's Nikki Haley's son, unbelievable. We got to deal with these people's kids now. He's like a young kid too, right? Like
the sort of rat race that Charlie Kirk's assassination has set off on. Ooh. The right is shocking to behold.
That's exactly what this is, right?
Exactly. Everybody, there's Bryland Hollyhand. The son of like a slumlord. Maybe I'd want to. The son of a. That's my opinion, based on the facts that I know.
Matt's on camera now.
but the developer,
I would have thought like candy magnet or something like that, like with a name like that. It's so whimsical.
I know, not just, you know, trying to build housing in, you know, the South, as his father's doing, you know, that gets in private jets or whatever. And then, of course, there's the Fuentes stuff, who really seems to be in pole position there and the sort of bending over for everyone. But here's a new one. Nalen Haley.
Yeah, Nalen Haley is his name.
Okay, cool. Yeah. That's fine. He's a, yeah. We're going to see. I've seen some of this stuff before. I've seen his Instagrams of him like with his luxury car on the side of the road. But I'm curious to see how Nalen, whatever it is, on Fox News with, who is this?
Who is it? Oh, Rachel Campos Duffy.
Oh, wonderful.
And this is his TV debut. This is the red carpet rollout.
Ooh.
We have Nalen Haley in his very first television appearance. Nalen, thank you so much for joining us today. So why don't we start with, what are these anxieties that your generation, I think I laid some of them out. What does your generation think is the answer to these anxieties?
Well, a big problem is that we are seeing kids graduate with six figures in debt and not having a job to show for it. My main friend group graduated with great degrees from great schools. It's been a year and a half since graduation. Not one of them has a job, not one. And when we look at all the other statistics,
including
we
you.
See that 58% of recent college graduates are unemployed. Of those 42% that are employed, 50% of them are having temporary jobs or jobs that don't require a degree. And then when you look at affordability in the housing market, my parents probably bought their first house for $90,000, and now it's probably worth $400,000. I don't see how I'm ever going to own a home. And I do pretty
well. He's sorry. I didn't mean.
Come I mean, I think he
I
is
think
going to be fine. I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, for myself,
trying to relate to his audience that he cannot relate to. Please.
I mean, that's Trump's America.
All his stories are my friend group because he can't talk about himself because he's a millionaire.
Until right there, when he tried to pretend he wasn't never going to own a home. Please.
I'm looking at him. It looks like he's. I think this maybe in. This is in Europe somewhere. On vacation, I'm looking at him, and the caption is, only thing lagging is the jet. I think he's going to be all right. And I'll just point out, for those of us that you're trying to like pretend you represent, Nalen, who don't come from like political dynasties, those are failures of capitalism you're talking about. I actually I was always a sort of progressive Obama guy in college. It wasn't until the time after college, the year and a half that I took sort of bouncing around jobs, including working on the set of Mob Wives for about a week, but where I couldn't actually put my NYU degree to use, was actually very radicalized for me. And so I'd say all the young people who graduated with college and are now looking at debt because you don't have, you know, parents like Nalen who can just pay for your college in this really expensive time, you should never have to got a permission from a fucking banker to pay for your college. The United States government should have done it for you. You should not be in debt. And it is an attack on you. It's a class assault. This is class warfare that you are indebted with that. John Swartz of The Intercept has a great piece about the Reagan administration advisor literally saying, we are at the risk of producing an educated proletariat. That is something we cannot do, and that's why they started putting all these bankers and charging all this interest on student loans instead of following what could have been passed, because Reagan saw what happened with like the Cal system, where it was like very publicly supported education for people, and that lets people stand upright and not have to worry about how they're going to pay their debt so they can work for some corporation like Nalen Haley and his friends, you know, are going to have to do now because they're in hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. This is failures of capitalism. But I'm curious, where does Nalen, this young man, who does he blame for this?
And let's keep in mind he has Indian heritage. Either his, I don't know if Nikki was born here or his grandparents.
Right.
That's important to what he's about to say.
So it's not just me that's feeling it. It's everyone feeling it. And you look at the crime and the lawlessness. In just the past couple months, I had someone who was shot and killed outside my apartment. And I live in what is considered a very safe area. In that same couple months, you had someone who was jumped over a bad drug deal. And I'm sick and tired of having to go to CVS and have to push a button for an employee to unlock the toothpaste.
Such a boomer thing to say.
This is America. This isn't what we do.
Other people die.
This isn't how things work.
Other people dying in, you know, sensationalized crime thing, which is, again, this is the strategy for as long as media has been mass media, literally the like pre-Civil War era. A huge part of the reactionary press was about sensationalizing horrible incidents that happen and using that to cultivate reactionary sentiment. We hear about somebody dining in a drug deal, getting shot with guns. And what is the solution to that is, I guess, just more cops. Let's pay for more and more police to do this, despite, you know, we jail more people than anyone in the world per capita. Yeah, let's play a little bit more.
Work. Things should be able to work. People should have jobs. Houses should be affordable. This isn't normalcy. And the American dream is becoming less and less attainable with each passing day.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Just this past week, we saw in the introduction by the Trump administration of the idea of a 50-year mortgage. What do you think about that?
Whatever will lower the cost of houses, because right now we are prioritizing a lot of foreigners who come in here to take jobs who work, and especially that's something we need to do. We need to get rid of the foreign worker visas. We need to ban H-1B visas, and we need to punish companies that are not putting.
I should just point out, this interview happened, I think, the day before Trump said, actually, Americans aren't talented. We need those H-1B visas.
Right.
No talented people in America. That's what I think. Those are his exact words.
Yeah. She said, we have talent. He goes, no, you don't. No, you don't.
No, no.
And, you know, the right wing is right for the absolutely most heinous reasons about H-1B visas. I have no problem extending an open door to people who want to work in this country. I think we should do it way more often. I think we should massively expand the sort of administration bureaucracy to get people citizenship. The H-1B thing is... there's a reason Trump and Elon Musk are defending it. And people get really upset about, get a bit sensitive about this, so we need to walk through this slowly. Most people who get H-1B visas do not eventually become citizens. They're not like Elon Musk. Most of them are kept in those conditions for a long time, and they are used by people like Musk and Trump, capitalists, to suppress wages, exactly for that reason. The way around that is, if we need you to come to this country to work, whether, first of all, it shouldn't be determined by, like, the capitalists. So, like, this whole thing of you need to pay $100,000. Well, what if hospitals need certain types of specialists or something? Do we want hospitals ponying up $100,000? No, it shouldn't be based on money. It should be based on common sense things like need. Like, we have a nursing shortage or something like that. It shouldn't be determined by tech billionaires who want to save on labor costs, which is what the system is being set up for and why it's being preserved now. And it is kind of like the Epstein stuff, where it's like they're actually implicated in this thing, but they point out like they're going to be against it until the rubber hits the road here and realizes like, oh, Sam Altman, Elon Musk, they have a real problem if we get rid of this H-1B thing. Everybody that is working for OpenAI or Tesla or whatever on these visas should have a much easier path to citizenship, because they'd be much more able to stand up for themselves and what they are building. And we have this situation now where we're creating this AI, we're creating all this sort of stuff. And when you have people under these sorts of visas, they're not as able to stand up and express their labor power.
Absolutely.
Because they're under these sort of limited rights regimes.
No, it's so true. Like, H-1B visas are something that people really hone in on, but it's just one mechanism by which, like, the working class is stratified, you know, segregated and made precarious. Like, H-1B visas exist because the type of worker that is needed for these positions can't be as precarious as the totally undocumented worker who is like picking strawberries in the fields of, like, you know, whatever state where they grow strawberries. Because, you know, you can't have ICE showing up to the IT department of Microsoft one day and deporting everyone there. That just wouldn't work for Microsoft, for the tech oligarchs who control our society. But it's not the only tool, right? Like, totally undocumented status is just one tool. You know, health insurance being tied to your workplace is another tool that is, you know, used against documented or naturalized citizens. The whole purpose is just to keep the working class against each other, but also as precarious as possible. And it goes back to what you were saying about the assault on people's ability to have any upward mobility through public education, not just at the college level, but at the you know, high school and below level too. People have been too stable, even though that seems insane given how bad things are. The capitalist class think that Americans have been too stable for too long. And that's evidenced by the, you know, what was the middle class in this country having, I know, a manner of savings for a few decades before it got wiped away in 2008 and just never really recovered.
Let's is there any more of Nayland here?
I mean, you get it. He's just gonna
immigrants
throw immigrants under the bus. But I do want to check in with another rich kid.
Okay.
Since we're doing these legacy children. This is Eric Trump.
Ooh.
And Eric Trump has some thoughts on conventional banking and the upside of Bitcoin.
Every single week.
Sorry. Man, I'm realizing how talented you are as a producer, Matt. One second. Let me put this up. But this is him explaining like why wire transfers are so difficult and how Bitcoin makes that better. And I think
That's a huge problem for me.
It's very relatable to the working man.
Yeah.
There's no reason at 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, I shouldn't be able to send out a swift wire transfer. You know, right now you can't. I try and make a transfer every single week, and you're trying to push before the 5 o'clock deadline to either receive money or to get it out. How is that modern day finance? You can send $500 million worth of Bitcoin on a Sunday night at 11 p.m. while having a glass of wine with your wife, virtually zero fees. How is the system this lethargic? Why does it take you 120 days to get go through Know Your Customer with your bank if you want to get a home mortgage?
Fraud?
It doesn't make any sense. Cryptocurrency is going to fix everything.
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead, Brandon.
I don't want to defend the surveillance state. And so I hate to fall back on the kinds of things that people said when, you know, they were defending the Patriot Act. But I just don't imagine that you would need to do something like that for legitimate reasons. Like when you say it like that, it sounds like you're trying to like pay Agent 47 or pay like some kind of like hitman to take out James Bond when you're just having a glass of wine and sending like an undocumented transfer. And it's just like, I don't know, like there's a reason we have financial like laws that prevent stuff like that.
Yeah. Do you remember 2008? I'd recommend, Eric, I know you do a lot of reading, David Dayan's book Chain of Title that goes into the massive amounts. I mean, massive is underselling it. The sort of planet-sized fraud that undergirded the collapse in the housing markets that destroyed the American dream. like just giant amounts of fraud created by banks where they didn't even like know who exactly had the properties that they were packaging up into financial instruments and reselling. I want to be careful here because I'm in the big chair. It's hard for me to think of this as anything other than these are criminals that want it to be easier to do crimes. Because, yes, Know Your Customer. Who knows about Know Your Customer except people like that is explicitly about let's make sure that people aren't laundering drug money through our bank.
Yeah, the only use that crypto people have ever come up with for crypto is gambling and other forms of like undocumented wire transfers, which usually constitute like money laundering or financial crimes. Sometimes they'll say things like, oh, it's to escape capital control, which is just a funny way of saying like money laundering in a country you don't live in.
Right.
Like, oh no, like when I need to like get money in and out of China, like without being caught by the Chinese government, like I use crypto. It's like, that's still a crime. It's just a crime in China, like, and not in the United States. So, you know, crypto's main use case is facilitating crime. And so when I hear Eric Trump do stuff like this and, you know, Donald Trump pardoned CZ, it all like paints a portrait of like their financial dealings that is, you know, not above board.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd also emphasize
if you can believe it.
Yeah.
It's putting it mildly.
The biggest crime, you know, of course, there's a sort of drug deals and, you know, probably even more illicit types of buying and selling that might go on. The big thing I want to point out is the libertarian element to this, which is actually I would call fascistic, because this idea that we should have a world where money can freely cross borders.
So say,
what was that?
is Alex Karp. I'm queuing up the next one.
The world, I think something calling me a pussy.
You don't love crypto?
Pussy.
Fortune okay, favorite but, the brave.
But let's talk about philosophically about this crypto bullshit. Because a lot of these guys are very like border fascists as well. And that is a huge contradiction, because the idea that rich people should be able to move money across borders freely and seamlessly and at Friday at 5 p.m. But
after 5
p.m. militarize after 5 p.m. but we should militarize the border so people cannot cross it is creating a fascist future for this planet. And there are so many people who call themselves libertarians that you should spit on that term when they deploy it. If you support Bitcoin and crypto for that whole, hey, it's one world, man, who needs borders? And then on the exact same breath, you say, oh, yeah, we need even common sense deportation militarization. Fuck you.
That's a great, it's a great, great point. I mean, it just shows where their priorities are. Like the whole bringing up the scenario of him sending $500 million in crypto at 11 p.m. on a Sunday night while he's drinking wine with his wife. Is that a relatable scenario for the average American? Are we all just lounging about on a Sunday, drinking a fine wine while transferring hundreds of millions of dollars? I mean, give me a break. I mean, it's just not a situation that people, most people, are concerned with, and it is 100% them complaining that there are still some basic guardrails that are stifling their ability to do even more crime.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there's actually a recent. Are we going to say something, Brandon?
Yeah, just quickly to your point. I mean, it's definitely like philosophically, like, you know, not great, but they're also not particularly as interested in crypto's like ability to transfer money between like countries. And that's, you know, that's like one of the selling points, but the right. only interest that like the Trump administration and his kids have when it comes to crypto transfer, it's like transferring wealth from like the rubes who follow them and think that they're going to get in on the ground floor of some new coin to like the bank accounts of the Trump family, right. You know, like that's what they're interested in transfer, like the transfer of wealth from like the bottom, you know, percentile of Americans who still believe and trust in them to like themselves. And then, of course, like transferring it to some Swiss account somewhere that they won't have taxed or whatever. But it's just become the most effective way for people with large platforms of incredibly gullible people to like separate those people from their money and put it in their own bank accounts. And I think that's why like the Trump administration and like his kids love it like so much more than, you know, they ever have before.
Yeah. Dark Soul on the IM says the only reason I know your customers from watching people like Kit Boga cover scams and pig butchering schemes and him trying to push for banks to have even stronger systems against fraud. Exactly. Like the idea that you would know about know your customer and think like this is bullshit such a self-report. It's unbelievable. There's an article here on Jeffrey Epstein's relationship with JP Morgan Chase that came out that might be instructive for the Trump boy there. Investigation by the Times. Late 90s, Jeffrey Epstein opens up an account that would become JP Morgan Chase, generating $8 million in fees for JP Morgan. So you don't want to know your customer too well. If, hey, we know that they're going to generate $8 million in fees for me, withdrew over $175,000 in cash. Interesting. Why? And they were later found to match payments to women. So there's no mystery about what the cash was being used for. Epstein brokers, JP Morgan Chase, $1.3 billion of Highbridge Capital. So nice. Just do a deal with your banker. You know, he's doing a lot of fees with us. Let's do some bigger deals. So, yeah, $1.3 billion acquisition of a capital company, received $15 million from the deal. Massive cash withdrawals, over $1.7 million in 2004 and 2005 alone. Just cash. Any of that in cash, please. That's why you know your customer. Because, or just don't. Or don't get away with it forever. Because I don't know if any of these people have really faced anything besides like maybe some of them had to retire early or something like that. But that's the biggest bank in America. That was the biggest bank in America that was handing out cash to a guy to deal women on the market to people like, to people like, I mean, whoever he did it with, let's just say that, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's they're essentially complaining, not even that the system is stopping them from doing crime. They're complaining that the system is making it cumbersome for them to do crime. Like, they're still doing the crime and getting away with it, but the crime's taken, you know, 5 business days instead of overnight.
Well, I mean, like, they're the scammers. So obviously, like, they're mad about, like, anti-money laundering and KYC laws. Like, they're the people on the other end of the line trying to get you to install the, you know, trying to get you to install the, like, remote operating program on your computer. It's like, you know, they just happen to be the president's son. So it's like the beekeeper, actually, almost exactly. And so, like, of course, they're mad about the safeguards that protect the average consumer from being scammed. That's why they got rid of the CFPB, too. They, like, it was just too helpful to, like, the average consumer who they want to scam out of what little money they have left.
Let's do this Hannity clip, if we can here. Just another good example of how to respond to this. Now, there is going to be a time where Democrats are going to need to talk about something besides Jeffrey Epstein. I hope that time's after they reckon with, say, the Clinton family's entanglements with them and maybe other Democrats that are invited for some reason to opine about economic policy that are really at the forefront of my mind today as this disgusting pig is all over the news. You need a number on that one? 15? So our boy Sean Hannity, the guy who used to be a soccer fan but then switched to throwing a football around because of masculinity. We're talking about masculinity today, folks.
Of course.
Is that a real story? I think I remember or recall hearing that, but that's something
that's
that he said.
That's an old Sam story. Apparently when he was in radio or something, he used to have some sort of thing in that breaks where he would throw a soccer ball around and then people would get it.
Real.
Oh, wow.
Real Ben.
Soccer's too progressive.
Too European for him.
Here's our boy Sean Hannity with who is this?
Stephanie Miller. I guess she's got a radio show. That's what.
Stephanie Miller's like a long time like liberal talk show host. I think she had a show on Air America back in the day, like in the 2000s or something like that. She's still going at it. She received some criticism for a jokey picture she took. I don't approve of it, but she says it's a joke of her kissing the feet of Representative Crockett. And so that picture went viral, and apparently it went viral enough for Sean Hannity to decide to reach out and get her on his show to talk about the picture.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do that. But do what she does here.
Right. And to set this up, this was from yesterday, and this is when all those emails were leaked. And for some reason, we know why Hannity's doing a piece on Biden's cognitive decline.
Oh, yeah, timely.
Sure, anything, but all right, so I do have a question. I tried to get an answer out of you on radio. Mm-hmm. Okay, the question is, when did you notice Joe Biden's cognitive decline? And don't change the subject and deflect. When did you really notice it?
Well, I think it was through all of the times that Donald Trump has fallen asleep in public and talked about, you know, magnets getting wet in the last few, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
My mom had dementia, so I recognize it.
Stephanie, this is not, it's a very good deflection. You're a professional.
You know
radio
what else is great
shows.
About
very good.
Biden's decline is that Trump is all over the Epstein files, and I'm wondering if they're going to tonight.
Got him.
Not really, because the woman that apparently they're talking about is the one that said he was a gentleman and never did anything wrong. And the person that had a grudge was the guy that got thrown out of Mar-a-Lago 25 years ago. And by the way,
for what?
When you get thrown out of a club in Palm Beach, Florida, that's kind of a big deal. And it's very humiliating and embarrassing. And he was a convicted pedophile. Not exactly.
Sounds like my president.
Is that what?
Trump was mad that he was stealing his question. Girls, but yeah.
Getting kicked out of a Palm Beach club is such a big deal that you don't even need to be charged for a crime for it. You've already served your time.
You faced the biggest punishment of all.
You can't be at Mar-a-Lago.
I think his point was like, you know how sleazy you have to be to get kicked out of like a Palm Beach club? Like that really shows that like he was a not good guy. Like, you know, Trump had never been kicked out of a Palm Beach club. So who are you going to believe?
But this was this.
Make
you
sure
know,
the
this...
audio's big on the high enough on the sound for the video.
No, I was just going to say the, you know, she got on the show and he wanted to obviously talk. I think this preceded this came this section of that clip came right after he shows the picture on the screen of her kissing Jasmine Crockett's feet. And he brings it up to her and she says, you know, it was a joke. And then she immediately starts talking about Trump and the Epstein files and everything. So shockingly Hannity let her stay on and she kept doing it, which is great. It's a smart way. If you ever find yourself in some situation where Fox News or some right wing media outlet wants you to come on, and you are ready to handle it as Stephanie Miller did, or you're ready to handle it in some other way that shines a light on them, then do it. Take advantage of the opportunity. That's what she did here. I think it was very smart.
Yeah, I'll do the Alex Karp thing next. I mean, it's a very simple sort of process. Whereas, like, if you don't need to be invited back, Hannity needs to produce a show, and you have been selected for that day. That is going to need to go up tonight. So make it worth his while. And I saw Grace Blakely did a good sort of reel on Instagram about was it Lakoff or one of those sort of 90s spinmeisters, but never accept the frame of your opponent. Don't even talk about it. Like, talk about what you want to talk about. Don't accept what they want you to talk about and respond to what they want you to talk about. Just talk about what you want to talk about. You know, you don't need to respect a guy who's still talking about Joe Biden's dementia.
Exactly.
When he is supporting a demented president himself in the current moment.
And also, Trump is just really weak on this. Like, you know, for, you know, all it's worth and how disgusting it is in reality, Trump is also incredibly weak on this issue. His fan base takes a lot of like psychic damage when this is brought up. I think Harry Enten has a new poll on this where like it's -36 approval. I mean, yeah, on this particular issue for Trump. And so it's just something that, you know, rightfully so, he's very weak on, and they should hit him on it harder. But they can't, obviously, on the Democratic side because of how deeply implicated some of them are and also like their donors are in this particular mess.
It's almost catching up with them, which is a very weird feeling that like all these premises that they set in motion to attain power, like the Epstein stuff, the cost of living stuff, the affordability crisis. I'm tired of hearing about affordability and the age stuff. It is a literal hoisted by their petard of all of those issues because you have to be, you haven't been president for even a year in this term yet, buddy. And you know, every once in a while you look like you have a little pep, but don't compare it to the first term because you will see a massive slowing, an alarming transformation for an elderly person. Oh, we got Harry Emden here. Let's
Harry Enten.
Harry Enten.
You know, Donald Trump is underwater on basically every single issue he ran on in 2024. But the Epstein files, the Epstein case, are especially dreadful for him. What are we talking about here? Well, let's take a look at Trump's net approval rating on the issue. Look, they're all in red. They're all in the negative territory. But on immigration, you know, he's 5 points underwater. Foreign policy, 8 points. Trade and tariffs, he's 17 points. The economy, 18 points. But look at the Epstein case. He is 39 points below water on the Epstein case. His net approval is 39 points in the negative. My goodness gracious. What Donald Trump has been selling on the Epstein files, the Epstein case, the American people, simply put, have not been buying at all, Sarah Seidner.
All right. So is there any sign that things have gotten better?
I mean, his position on the Epstein case is I'm not in them. I mean, that's his position. So that is obviously polling not well with people.
Well,
I mean, it's not looking good for him.
Not even that.
To be fair,
Democratic hoax is his take.
Yeah. To be fair, that's still a step in the right direction from Epstein, which was like his position for like a week and a half before people rejected that.
This guy's been talking about it for years.
It's also a very weird thing to poll. Like those other things are like policy. Right. Like it's very bizarre. Like ask,
how do they frame it?
Yeah, like what's your position on Donald Trump and the Epstein? Like what your position on him being in the files, or obviously
him releasing his handling of the release? I think it's a question.
Like, but like, who's gonna be like, yeah, I think Donald Trump's handling the Epstein files great. I think his position of pretending don't exist and ignored it completely, even though I have obsessively focused on it personally for the past 8 years of my life. I think that's a fantastic position. Like, what is the question for that?
I think it's literally people who are on the flight logs. I agree with how he's handling it because I am myself implicated in this vast conspiracy.
Yeah, Alan Dershowitz agrees.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think the president should be on the registry? Yes, no, maybe is like the question. And then they just extrapolate the answer based on that.
And just where the congressional state of play is here. So Trump, again, like we mentioned, called in Lori Boebert to the Situation Room. Like, Lauren, we got a situation. You need to stop listening to those victims. and they're expecting a lot of defections among the Republican Party on the House vote. So if you do want to, if you are living in a red district and want to call your representatives, today would be a good time to call them and tell them we want full transparency and you to sign onto this and mention Boebert and Massey. Don't mention, you know, the Democrats. Transparency about Epstein. It would be worthwhile to do it because it's if it passes the House, then it dies in the Senate and Trump never signs it. Either of those is important, I think, politically to show that the GOP is a as Ilhan Omar said, basically a pedophile protectionist racket. And this is not the first time. This exact same shit has happened with Republicans number of times. Dennis Hastert and like the 2006 weird shit going on with like pages and stuff like that. It's been a long time. Jim Jordan, who, it's interesting how he rose up the leadership. I wonder if that if certain things that we would consider liabilities become assets to this party. It's a little bit we are in a fight against organized predation.
And, well, yeah, that's it.
They are running scared right now.
No, that's it. Because people will say this is not a left or right issue, but it is. Like, the conservative value system is one that, like, you know, values domination. It's one that fetishizes, like, you know, virginity in women. So, like, it seems to lead to these sorts of things more often than not, which is not to say that, like, it's not a broader problem within our society. But on the right, these are, like, virtues. Like, the
it's part of their politics. It's part of their ideology. Yeah,
but when they that's surprise, how the mafia works. Like, everybody has a gun pointed at each other because they all have dirt on each other.
Yeah, they just told themselves it doesn't lead to stuff like this. They go like, oh, yeah, like, we value predating on each other. And also, like, we think that any woman over the age of 20 is too old. But, like, how could it lead to this? That's crazy.
Right. That's
Michael Wolff
point.
Literally told Jeffrey Epstein that you can win this over on the backlash to PC culture. You a transatlantic pedophile fixer can just say this is wokeness.
No,
it's run amok.
That should really tell people what this whole anti woke thing is all about, right? Yeah, I mean, this isn't just a mirror to a single individual or a single group of people using anti-wokeness as defense. That's what the vast majority of this is. For anyone to care so much about anti-wokeness, to make it their entire being, what are they doing that they're so afraid will get out there or will get them, quote-unquote, canceled? Because we've already seen people who are just canceled for just their speech. Like a comedian who is no longer allowed to go to a college campus for a single show and then all of a sudden turns that into an entire industry for them and makes tons of money. We've already seen that getting canceled is the most lucrative thing that can possibly happen to you unless there's actually something there for you to get canceled about, like something like being a pedophile or abusing women or being a domestic abuser or something like that. There's always... 9 times out of 10, there's something underlying there in the anti-wokeness ideology that's really just a defense mechanism to hide stuff like that.
And a lot of people are also just like trying to defend the structures of oppression that they've been taught to cling on to. Like a big part of why people will defend predators in positions of power is because they've been taught that, like, well, it's better to have a position or a predator in a position of power like Andrew Cuomo than it is for the entire social order to fall apart. Like, wouldn't you rather to have like a rich white predator be president than to have like, you know, uncontrolled masses of brown people preying on like the streets? And that, like, and that's, you know, that's the way people think about it. Or like, oh, if we get rid of all these predators in high positions in art, then we just won't have good movies anymore. And people have been taught to just think that way. Like, it's a trade-off that we just have to make. And it keeps obviously marginalized people out of power and positions of prominence. And it just continues to cement that the domination on those groups of people is virtuous for a lot of people. So they defend it. They defend it without thinking about it.
Look, you have to separate the pedophilia from the pedophile.
Yeah, you know, that brings up a question I've been wanting to ask and I would like an answer to. Why did Ezra Klein say that thing about he was a very high connected guy and also a big time pedophile and those things mostly never overlap?
They seem to be directly related, actually.
Right. Like, why say that? He said that on a podcast, on the New York Times podcast, like this summer. And it's just like you're writing a certain kind of check there that I feel like people are going to, you know, make come due pretty quickly. And of course, it's just a weird thing to say. You have a bender?
I just think
I'm looking for it. All right, here we go. So I think this was in a written piece. I think I should say before I – oh, no, it was – this is the transcript from the yeah. podcast. Yeah. I think I should say before I start this episode where I am on the Epstein story. I mean, I think hopefully most people wouldn't have to say where they are on it. But if you forced me to give you my best guess, I think this guy had a lot of powerful friends. He's talking about Epstein. I think this guy had a lot of powerful friends and that he was a predator and a pedophile. And those sides of his life were mostly separate. How would you come to that conclusion? Like what is the point of having powerful friends if you're and using it for the way that Epstein would want and not end up being someone using those powerful connections to do illicit behavior? Those worlds are completely connected.
Well, I think at the surface level, that's just part of defending the powerful people in his life that he probably knows are implicated in this particular conspiracy or organization. And, you know, I think underneath that, there's also the taking to the illogical conclusion, something that is very prominent in the way we think about politicians, which is that there is some sort of significant divide between their like public and private lives that has to be respected. That like you can advocate for like, you know, even Charlie Kirk is a good example of that. Like you can advocate for the erosion of civil rights, of the social safety net, for like the driving into extreme poverty or even genocide of people all around the world publicly as a public figure, as like a, you know, a commentator, as like a, you know, a politician. You can even enact laws that put that stuff forward. But like because you have a private life somewhere that has family and friends and people who love you, those two things have to be divided. Like, you know, one can't possibly implicate the other. And so I do think there's a little bit of that too. Like in order for people to feel good about all the bad things that they do within our like political media system, or for all the bad things our politicians do, you know, as laundered through our procedural legislature, like they just insist that there's some sort of like harsh divide between people's public and private life. And this is just like a crazy example of that too. Like, you know, it's directly related for sure. Like one was definitely related to the other. And it always is, right? Like that's same with Trump. Like Trump and like the things that he does in office are directly related to the way he treats people in his normal life.
Yeah, I mean, not even getting into the international connections, whether it's sort of Israel stuff or, you know, selling surveillance states in Africa or whatever, his entire personal life was fueled by cash that he was withdrawing from JP Morgan Chase. And he was personal friends with Jess Staley, who this New York Times thing goes into, basically overruled several compliance complaints underneath them. A guy named William Lankford said, no patience for this. Stephen Cutler called Epstein not an honorable person in any way. And he had powerful friends that allowed him to, you know, live that role. And, you know, I'll answer my own question of what I think Ezra was doing there is I think he had that discussion with Ta-Nehisi Coates where he confessed to not knowing what his role is now. And Ghestani, he's asked him, do you know what your role is? And Ezra's response was, I would just like to pursue my curiosities in political peacetime or something like that. But the role he is playing is that of a liberal bedtime storyteller. And that everything's okay and you can go to sleep just fine. Everything's going to be all right. And we're actually all in this together. And I think that's what motivated that statement. I think it's a desire for him for this to be a smaller story than it is, for the world to be less corrupt than it is. Because it is probably scary. Like, you know, we have a certain prominence in this. As the world gets darker, it is scary to be so forward on this. It might be scary to be Ezra Klein at this moment of, like, rising fascism, and you represent liberalism. And you might want to, like, look away from the sort of abyss that we are staring into. We don't have patience for that. And that's why he's like, losing a lot of audience from liberals, especially over the Charlie Kirk stuff, because we haven't looked away.
Yeah. I think irrespective of where you think he's coming from, it's all the same, in service of the same thing, the defense of power, defense of the status quo. This is all like centrism, you know, by one form or another. He's defending the status quo and the way things are, even though it has delivered things like Jeffrey Epstein and his best friend becoming president, because to fully interrogate how that happened would be to, like, you know, condemn the entire system that led to it. Like, why was Donald Trump never caught before this point? Like, you know, despite not just the things that he may have been doing Jeffrey Epstein, but all the other, you know, illicit activities he was up to.
So one final segment on Testosterone Thursday. Palantir CEO Alex Karp has become a regular fixture on the Fun Half.
He's given like one interview in the last week, and it's just a trove.
You know, from an entire class of people who are so up their own ass that they call themselves stuff like founder, as we get destroyed by China on all these sorts of fronts, he has some thoughts to say about the crisis of masculinity here and the Democratic Party. Let's hear him talk with, who is this, Mike Allen?
It's, I forget, but it's the Axios show.
Right.
I forget his name.
And I'll also say both parties, and again, let me just go to the party where I have more credibility. Like, the way in which the Democrats just completely neglect males. Like, there is nothing wrong, and it's admirable to be a somewhat to high testosterone male. And, you know, it's like, there's, you have the general vibe in the Democratic Party that it's like there's, like, there's something wrong. I don't know. Like, I just, like, yeah, I, it's,
wow.
It, there's some way in which it's, I don't find it very appealing as a dude. I don't think most dudes do. It's a huge problem and you can't address it. And I'll also say both parties, and again, let me just go to the party where I have more credibility. Like,
he keeps saying
the way in which the Democrats just completely neglect males.
Oh, it's, like, it's a replying.
There is nothing wrong. And it,
yeah,
that's how bad of a speaker is. You can't tell where it's ends.
But even though he just said it once, I still, it caught my attention right away the first time when he said, let me speak to the party I have more credibility with. He's doing that thing that we see time and time again, where someone with right wing views but is embarrassed about being a part of the right because of the, you know, the culture or whatever there, that, or the lack thereof. He's doing that thing where he thinks he sounds more credible by pretending he's actually on the other side, but the Democrats are losing him. You know, we've seen this time and time. We know exactly the types. We've seen it with, you know, the Dave
Chuck
Rubens.
Norris.
We've seen it with all these guys.
Have you seen Chuck Norris? It's like every time he's like, Chuck Norris finally breaking with, it's, I think it's Chuck Norris. And it's like, no, he's been doing this since 2004.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he switched parties like during LBJ or something. Honestly, that's when the Democrats lost him. I'm serious. I mean, they love doing that because it gives them, or at least they think it gives them, some sort of legitimacy in what they're saying.
Yeah, this is also just built into his, this interview earlier. He was asked about Nick Fuentes. And he, the way he dodged answering any question about Nick Fuentes was saying, I don't have any credibility on the right, so let me just speak to the party I understand. And it was that was like built into his deflection.
And it's true. He doesn't. That's why he's so up his own ass about supposedly having credibility on the left, is because people hate him, that know who he is on the right. They think of him, because they understand Palantir, as we all do, as a threat against normal people. And he does have, like, I mean, he's to the left of Peter Thiel. Okay. So, like,
yeah,
that, so he's a leftist now. He has credibility.
Yeah. Also, like, you know, the right has more of a hate relationship with big tech than the left does. Big tech was always the left's, like, favorite form of billionaire. Yeah. And so the fact that they abandoned the Democrats in the last election, at least they were perceived to, like, you know, makes them feel more valuable to the left, because they can be the left, to Democratic Party, because they can hold that over their heads and, you know, force them to jump through hoops to win them back. Because that's also a difference between, like, the right in the form of the Republicans and the Democratic Party. Like, when when people do this, take this position about, like, being a liberal in exile, Democrats will jump through hoops for them. Like, Republicans don't really do that. Republicans don't, like, if you were to go and try to do this exact same grift about being ejected from the right because of, like, Donald Trump being, like, a, you know, they just wouldn't have you on. Like, right, they wouldn't platform you.
Yeah. It's sort of like the narrative of, like, the escaped captivity narrative that's been, like, basically the main sort of American stories for 400 years I saw what it was like on the other side of our enemies. Well, and now I'm coming back to tell you about how bad they are.
Everyone loves a convert. I guess they do that on the left, because that was like the Lincoln Project, right, kind of thing. But then it turned out they had some sort of weird, like, you know, issues themselves, because they're still conservatives, and, you know, you don't hear as much about them anymore.
Yeah, it would be nice to hear less from the Never Trump conservatives. I just saw Tim Miller tweet something, and I would just say, like, if you're a Never Trump conservative, stick to telling what Republicans what they should be doing. Don't be giving advice to Democrats. But that's just me.
Yeah, I will say there are a few of them that strictly know their role, and that is to be anti-Trump, and they don't wade into pretending they know what's best for Democrats. And to those few, I respect that. The ones who come in thinking you're going to tell the Democrats what to do, no, your role and where you could be most helpful is speaking out against Trump, the guy who represents where you came from. You don't have a say in what the Democrats or the left do. Thank you very much.
Yep, exactly. We want to play this of Alex Karp.
Well, first I want to show this cool picture of him. So he was giving a talk to Palantir people, and in his intro, he projected this, which is him shirtless with a sword, and it says he has a PhD in neoclassical social philosophy.
That's the sort of stuff they make.
Cool stuff.
They make fun of. he's some sort of tech samurai, but and it looked pretty impressive in that still image. So I mean, wait till you see it in video here with Molly O'Shea. I don't know who Molly O'Shea is. I think she's like some sort of tech reporter. Maybe you've come across her work, Bender. I would just say to Molly, stand back a little bit, maybe in the future, because you almost were at risk of becoming the story yourself.
I had to play this with no sound because DMX is on it.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And there he is. He's showing off for the young girl interviewing him by thrusting his sword.
It's there, like a scene from The Office. This is like you think, of Michael,
really
Scott,
is.
You think of Michael Scott type bit.
See, high testosterone.
Yeah, that's the masculinity just coming off of his body. He can't contain it. It's going to come out of that. I mean, these guys have like a like fantastical idea of what masculinity is, which is, I guess, the main problem. They view this cringy shit as being like manly men, where most like people who you would consider to be manly men, that like idea of one, don't view this shit as being masculine or anything. Like, they don't care.
Well, I think they feel
sword. That's cool.
Well, I think they feel masculine in the current like political climate because it's so tied up with like financial success. And so for a lot of the people who feel as though they've been robbed of their masculinity, it's because they have no access to legitimate pathways to wealth or even like subsistence within the current state of our economy. And they don't see that stuff even being possible in their life. That's why they supported Trump in the last election. It's why they've abandoned him now, because he's not actually delivering on that stuff, because there's a big portion of our, you know, population who associate like being successful and productive in the workplace far past what is reasonable now, given what they've been fed on TikTok and Instagram by influencers. They just don't see a pathway to that. And they're attracted to narratives that will empower them in that landscape. And a lot of those narratives are rooted in like classical ideas of masculinity that, you know, insist upon the domination of women, but that doesn't actually get them the jobs. Like, you know, it won't actually empower them by like allowing them to afford things. It will just empower them by like increasing the distance between them and whatever or whoever happens to be on the bottom rung of society, which for some people is enough. And they harken back to a time where they had that plus like the ability to feed themselves. But I don't think in the absence of the ability to feed themselves, it's going to work. Like even his policy on immigration, Trump's policy on immigration, is becoming less popular because for all of the pomp and circumstance, things are more expensive than ever. Houses are more unaffordable than ever. Like stuff besides eggs are more unaffordable than ever. So like the mystique that like somehow like sending or cracking down on immigrants was going to like lead to the reduction in people's financial stress is just being disproven in real time.
Yeah. These guys, Alex Karp, this entire sort of tech constellation, all the podcasters that have them on to talk to them for like 3 hours about this same sort of bullshit, they are responsible for the so-called whatever masculinity crisis we're having, that our models for what a man should be is people like speculators, like Bitcoin speculators, these guys who create shareholder value in tech firms, who like I guess they're busy enough just to walk around their office with swords. Like that's what a man is supposed to grow up to be, is to be a guy who like gets government contracts to pay out for your company. That's bullshit. There used to be a time where like we glorified people for building like the Hoover Dam and shit like that. And now it's like, are you doing a side hustle? Are you drop shipping something? Do you have a crypto holding? Yeah.
Are you a scammer?
Are you letting AI create businesses for you to make passive income?
Are you trafficking women? Are you actively exploiting and pimping out women? Like
Andrew Tate, exactly. I mean, this is the bankruptcy of the basically, I don't know if you want to call it conservative male or just like our current leaders that have been propped up in whatever stage of, I would say, like failure stage capitalism, where it's very clearly not meeting any of the imperatives that society has for it, whether it's climate change or even just employing people or putting fucking groceries on the table. Like it's failing. And we have these fucking losers showing their Aladdin swords off to tech journalists.
Well, I think at this stage, it's just become a lot more openly predatory. There are a lot more people now who feel and I think have fully embodied this idea that in order to be successful, you basically have to be scamming or putting other people down in the form of like, you know, anti-woke politics on the right wing media. Like things like that are the only way ahead. And people have, I think, embraced that a lot more consciously. And I can't say it hasn't been modeled for them by our government and people in positions of power. So it does come from that, but it is a sign of like a waning of like people's feeling that there are legitimate pathways to wealth, and also a sign of the social alienation that is being, you know, resulting from that amongst other things. People feel a lot more comfortable because they are like antisocial and scamming each other and just like, you know, committing crypto fraud on each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Folks, we're going to read a few IMs and then get out of here on this Testosterone Thursday. Future reactionary, don't you think big tech is just navigating the center to keep the government contracts flowing or the regulations at bay? They seem to be actively trying to keep Democrats from leaning left. I think the way tech responded to Trump winning the second time, and not only winning this, but winning a trifecta in the Republicans winning a trifecta in Congress and the popular vote. I mean, they all came running because of that. And that's a problem with tech broadly right now, is Mark Zuckerberg doesn't have any fucking ideas to continue creating shareholder value, the meaning of a man in 2025. He has clearly no fucking clue.
But the metaverse was a huge success.
Exactly. No fucking clue.
Making creep goggles now. That's all he makes. Those creep glasses.
What they do, and I'm sorry for bending Sam's pen. What they do, their only idea now is to get government contracts for national security state. That's every, that's the play of Palantir. That's the play of all these companies right now. Even AI is like, oh, this is a national security thing. We need to be the Chinese at this. And we should not be trusting them. Let's say you grant that we're the good guys, China's the bad guys, and we need to beat them to this AI stuff. We're not going to do that with these fucking jokers leading the charge. Because, and I'm stealing this from someone on Twitter, but China is developing all this stuff in a more efficient way and a way more geared towards practical use to make their society better. All of these fucking lunatics are trying to create a computer god that will create a giant monopoly of compute that will make them kings. That is a hubris that will fail. They will not get there. And so, and we're going to be, I mean, actually, you know, whether we get hot, caught holding the bag or not is something I don't want to be too pessimistic about, because I think we could just let all these guys disappear and seize all their data centers for, you know, Uncle Sam, and then move on with all of our lives. And the economy would be just fine. Let's see here, a few more IMs. All right. Gonna skip that one about masculine. As a high testosterone male, I do not feel represented by the Republican Party. This is from Kowalski from Nebraska. There's nothing about Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, or Mike Johnson. What about Jordan Peterson? That screams masculinity to me. Just a lot of sexual repression and insecurity. The most masculine man in Congress is Bernie Sanders, and if he wasn't married, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and if he wasn't married, LB Johnson couldn't hold a candle to that stud of a real man. Interesting. Well, I could say Bernie's the most manly man in Congress, I guess. That's not something I've thought of before.
Yeah, when I see Bernie, I turn into like that Looney Tunes caricature of a woman going, "I'm a man."
Let's see here. All these guys blame testosterone for being a dick. It's like sort of control. It's like it's out of their control. Yeah. Let's see here. I did think of Nayland Palin when I. That's why I had to linger on that name earlier today, because. Yeah, never mind. let's see another one here. I'm gonna need some Trump silhouette stickers to update my neighbors. Shoot you, la la la. Okay, so I'm kidding. I'm understanding why people read these ahead of time. For Canada Goose, this one looks safe. I'm always amazed at how much people defend rich people dodging taxes as a reason to not raise taxes on rich people. It is amazing, isn't it? Like, they'll move. Well, those places should tax them there too. Have fun living in, you know, a low tax state. Let's see here. Let's go to the top. I don't understand why y'all couldn't just have Sam call in from his bed. All the cool podcasts are doing it. This evil communist. And let's see here. I think that will be the last one of the day, folks. I appreciate you all joining us on this Testosterone Thursday, where we really tried to save all the sons of America, and we'll try to do it maybe again some other time, where you know, Emma's on her West Coast Don Draper style timings. But check out the Jacobin Show tomorrow, 10 a.m. Eastern. Go subscribe to Jacobin now so you don't miss out. And we will see you with Sam tomorrow on Casual Friday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I might have lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. And I shifted into you while I shifted in and out.